Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
How would Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Lincoln, the Roosevelts, Truman, and Eisenhower have approached today's federal debt crisis? In the new book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse, Bill White tells the remarkable story of fiscal heroes who imposed clear limits on the use of federal debt, limits that for two centuries were part of an unwritten constitution. Those American leaders borrowed only for extraordinary purposes and relied on well-defined budget practices to balance federal spending and revenues. That traditional fiscal constitution collapsed in 2001, according to White. And he's written the book to provide historical context for today's budget battles, dispelling common budget myths and distilling practical lessons from the nation's five previous spikes in debt. Bill White served as the mayor of Houston, Texas, and was twice reelected. He also served as the Deputy Secretary of Energy of the United States and received the prestigious John F. Kennedy Profiles and Courage Award for his leadership in response to Hurricane Katrina. In 2010, he received more votes for governor of Texas than any other Democratic candidate in the state's history. Again, the title of the new book is America's Fiscal Constitution. It's a pleasure to welcome Bill White to the roundtable.
Great to be with you, Joe.
What brought you to this subject?
You know, I was worried about federal debt. I wanted to understand where we had gone wrong. I knew that for most of the nation's history, we had balanced budgets except in emergencies. I'd worked in an administration where I saw people on both sides of the aisle in the 1990s working to balance the budget. I'd been the mayor of a big city and every city practically in the country under its charter can't borrow money to pay for routine operating expenses. So I wanted to understand what went wrong and also to provide a bit of a roadmap to how we get out of this mess.
You were the mayor of Houston, Texas. You look at this, and I think it's fascinating when you start and you say that we at least had some grasp up until 2001. So the obvious question is, what happened?
You know, at that time, people in each party, beginning with President Bush and Tom DeLay and some of the Republicans, but then later the Democrats did it, they broke the link between tax policy and spending policy. Listen, nobody has ever liked to pay taxes in the history of the United States of America. If anybody says they enjoy paying taxes, they're crazy. But we always understood that nothing was free and that pay-as-you-go was a way of regulating the size of government and ensuring that you did not mortgage the future of the country. In beginning in 2001, federal leadership, first in the Republican Party, then in both parties, had a tax policy, and then they had a spending policy. And if there was a gap between the promises or commitments made that required spending money and the tax policy, well, debt filled that gap. Essentially, debt was used to disguise the cost of government, and that had not been the common practice in the United States before then, not for routine expenditures.
You do address this in the book that many say now, again, we're going back to a problem that you believe really started to manifest itself in 2001, that now, all these years later, we look at it and say it's politically impossible to balance the budget, which is something that you argue vigorously against and believe that it is possible.
Absolutely. I mean, if you take the last spike of debt in American history, the one before the current spike, after 16 years of Great Depression and World War II, debt reached a total that was greater than annual national income, as it did just last February for the second time in the country's history. But people had made tremendous sacrifices in order to win a great war and to create an international environment that was safer for the values that our country treasures. And I don't care where you were in the political spectrum, everyone from Henry Wallace to Robert Taft and Truman and Eisenhower in between. They all believed that we should immediately stop borrowing money after World War II, and that we should defer some types of expenditures that might be desirable, but they simply weren't affordable. And then when it came, when the United States decided to create a global security umbrella in 1950, following the North Korean invasion, when they decided that they wanted to strengthen the Social Security safety net, they raised taxes to do that because they did not want to encumber their kids with debt.
You write in the book about the American fiscal tradition as part of the unwritten or customary informal constitution. How did that come out of the founding fathers' view on debt?
See, they understood, Joe, well, the seduction of having elected politicians, just like the old monarchs, promise more than they were willing to charge in the form of taxes. And Jefferson, as a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, proposed to his friend James Madison, the architect of the Constitution, that there be a new constitutional amendment. Now, Madison sympathized with Jefferson's goals. He understood that the need for limits on debt. But he also understood that we would need to borrow from time to time in emergencies, such as during wars or severe downturns. So he proposed to Jefferson that they create some political principles that would be visible, clearly visible to the eye of the ordinary politician. That's what the words that he used. And for a long time they were. You'd only borrow for a handful of well-defined purposes. Every year you would start your budget planning based on your estimate of revenues. Accounting would be clear. If you raise taxes often, you put those taxes in an independent trust fund for a specific purpose so that voters could be assured that the taxes would be used as intended. Those were all part of America's historic fiscal tradition.
One of the things that is remarkable in reading the book is that the tradition lasted and worked for as long as it did, really.
Yeah. You know, a lot of people are looking back and they're trying to think about how we get our spending commitments and resources in line. Incumbents feel they're out on a limb. Some have, you know, promised no cuts in various sorts of spending. Others have promised no increase in taxes. And there's this, you know, feeling, and the people are looking back at back to 2000, both in the Bush and the Obama administrations, Republicans and Democrats in control of the Congress. I think they're looking at the wrong place. If they want to figure out what went wrong, it's good to start with understanding what had gone right for so long. And that leads me to have some conclusions at the end of the book about practices that once were used that made common sense that we ought to implement today.
Well, I'm going to get into those in a few moments. I do want to talk a little bit about some of the principles that have been with this country for a long time. You write about Jefferson in the book and ultimately talk about how he's become an icon for both progressives and conservatives in as far as fiscal leadership.
Yes, you know, first of all, folks who are, I guess you'd call more progressive, populist, if you will, look back on Jefferson as the first politician who is sort of overtly the voice of what we might call today the person on the street, you know, the ordinary guy. And at the same time, he was an oracle in warning of the dangers of unlimited government and an advocate of limited government. It's interesting, Joe, that progressives once thought that balanced budgets assured that funding for programs that they wanted, such as a social safety net, would be sustainable and was part and parcel of a whole set of values, including a commitment to public education and the environment to create a better future for the country. Conservatives also favored balanced budgets, for a somewhat different reason. Of course, they valued the future of the country, that everybody across the political spectrum wants, you know, their kids and grandkids to have more opportunities. But conservatives thought that so long as you raise taxes to pay for new programs, that would serve as a constraint on the growth of government. And they were right. I mean, you can see throughout American history times when people wanted to do things, but they couldn't afford them. Jefferson was one of them. He wanted to build a national university. He wanted to build a set of highways, or, you know, those thoroughfare, you know, they would have been, you know, more like pathways or for carriages. It wouldn't be for cars, obviously, but, something called the National Road and Canal System linking the interior to the coast. But he thought that those should be deferred until we paid off debt, for a very simple reason. When we paid off debt from the Revolution, then more money would be available because you wouldn't have to pay interest on that old debt. So you would have not only the money of new tax collections, but you would be saving money by not having to pay interest on that debt.
I mean, you talk in the book basically about how the current debt ceiling is a joke.
Right.
So what do we do to eradicate that and to restore some discipline fiscally?
First, to consider why it's a joke, just take a very recent example. In January, Budget Committee Chairman Ryan advocated a budget deal that he had worked out and that he voted for and that he lobbied for and that he defended, a basic budget resolution covering two fiscal years, the current one and the next one. And that budget deal authorized spending far more than available tax revenues, over $1 trillion more than available tax revenues over a two-year period of time. And even the earlier pure Republican budget with no compromise did about the same. It was just $100 billion left, but it still borrowed over $1 trillion over 2 years. Then in February, he votes against the use of debt to pay for the spending that he heard urged his colleagues to authorize. That's like somebody going into a restaurant and ordering something, food off the menu, knowing the prices, and then not having cash to pay and getting insulted when somebody asks you for a credit card. That's silly. What they ought to do is what they did in the old days. If you vote for a spending bill and appropriations that is greater than the tax revenues that are allocated to it, then at the same time you have to vote for the debt. Then you're on record as what you support borrowing to be used for. Then people who think that borrowing has got out of hand has a record of who voted for what kind of borrowing, rather than having the silly stuff now where Congress votes to spend a certain amount of money and then many of the same members of Congress vote against paying for it with either debt or taxes.
And one of the aspects to your plan, which I found fascinating and very important, and it seems to always be missing from the discussion, which is the necessity to engage the public in these decisions, which are often very difficult decisions.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is the sort of genius of democracy. I was mayor of the nation's fourth largest city for 6 years. I went to town hall meetings, between 5 and 20 times a week, and usually it was more like 7 to 10 times a week I was in town hall meetings. I talked to citizens about, you know, well, they want more police, or they want more of this or that, or they wanted to lower the property tax rate. And I had a candid conversation with the citizens. Since most of what we spend money for was public safety, if you want to lower taxes, we're going to have, you know, fewer crews available for police patrol or murder investigations or EMS runs. If you want more of those things, then we're going to have to raise property taxes. And then we would have an honest discussion about that. Today, many people are unaware that Medicare, since 2001, has increasingly been financed through debt. And it makes no sense. I think if there was an honest debate about how we pay for Medicare, some people may want to scale it back. Some people may want it to be just the way it is. There may be some people who want to add some things to Medicare. But whatever level of Medicare there is, we ought to pay for it in taxes, because it makes no sense at all to borrow to pay for Medicare bill and then not only have that expense, but the interest on that bill to account for.
Bill White is the author of the new book, America's Fiscal Constitution, Its Triumph and Collapse. The book is published by Public Affairs. Mayor White, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
You bet. You take care, Joe.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, America's Fiscal Constitution, it is published by Public Affairs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.